ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
My ears hurt.
Well, you know what the cure for a sore ear is, Luke? It's SciGuys live in London!
I don't know how that makes sense, but it's medically sound.
10 out of 10 doctors disagree.
But 10 out of 10 doctors agree that you should get your tickets now at SciGuys.co.uk/tickets. Don't they, doctors?
None of them are here, Luke.
You're not a doctor?
No, I'm not, Luke, and I feel like you should know that by now. But something that I'm sure you do know is that at SciGuys Live in London, you can get a live podcast, a Q&A, a meet and greet, a quickfire quiz, and also never-seen-before merch!
And finally, a special guest called Chanel Williams, is that correct?
That is very correct! Woo! So get your tickets now at SciGuys.co.uk/tickets. That's SciGuys.co.uk/tickets. And remember, patrons get a very special discount. Hello and welcome to The SciGuys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey and as always I'm joined by my co-host Luke Cutforth and this week's special guest, Dr. Richard Oakley.
Hey!
This week we're talking about the beginning of the end of Alzheimer's, but first, we have a wee YouTube comment.
How wee.
This one says, Corey, your job couldn't feasibly be obsolete. I know I can find all of this information myself, but you and Luke deliver it in such a tasty, entertaining way. Thank you.
And thank you for including me.
Yes, thank you very much. But before we get into the episode, I've got a question for everyone who is watching and listening. The question is, has Alzheimer's touched your life? Let us know in the comments below.
It has touched mine. And that's why I'm here.
And why are you here, Rich?
Yeah, hi, I'm Dr. Richard Oakley, Associate Director of Research and Innovation at Alzheimer's Society.
So my question for you both, I'm not sure if you'll be able to answer this, either of you. What is Alzheimer's?
I don't think I'll be able to answer that. I suspect there might be someone in the room who can answer that, though.
I'm not sure. I don't know.
It's a very complicated question, I have to say. So I'll take back one step, if I can, to what is dementia? So dementia is an umbrella term for a whole host of diseases of the brain, very similar to cancer, which is an umbrella term for a whole load of different diseases of your cells. Dementia is an umbrella term which basically means you've got a disease of your brain which is causing some symptoms which are common, which we know of. Forgetfulness is obviously one, and a whole host of general common symptoms. And the biggest cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease, mm-hmm. and that's about 60%. Of all cases of dementia. So it's a disease which is pretty common, which causes the symptoms, but there are many other diseases as well that cause dementia.
Absolutely. And that was something I didn't know until I started looking this up. I think I was saying before, I vaguely knew about sort of Alzheimer's and dementia, and I had no idea about any of the specifics. And it was actually quite illuminating just looking into it, because the information is very readily there, very, very easy to find if you just look for it.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, it's really interesting. And as you're saying, Alzheimer's is the most common cause of dementia in the UK. I've got some more stats here, which I'm sure you know, but I'll run through them for you, Luke, I suppose.
Thank you so much.
Just keep you in the loop. It's most common in people over the age of 65. And obviously, the risk will sort of increase with age. But it's not exclusive to people over the age of 65. If you're under the age of 65 and have Alzheimer's disease, that's classed as or called young onset or early onset Alzheimer's. So that's anyone under the age of 65. Do you have any idea roughly what sort of percentage or fraction of people that might affect, Luke?
I'm going to take a guess and then we'll ask Rich. I would guess maybe like 3%
of people with Alzheimer's.
Oh, sorry. I meant of people. But sure, 10% of people with Alzheimer's have early onset dementia.
Close. Not, I mean...
Oh, Rich gave a little nod. Look at that. I did it.
I think that isn't it 60,000 or something like that in my head. That could be wrong as well. But that's not bad.
I've got 1 in 20. So about 5%?
Okay.
That's maths, right?
That's maths.
I've maths that. Yeah, good. Yeah. As I was saying, the risk obviously increases with age. It affects an estimated about 1 in 14 people over the age of 65 and 1 in 6 people over the age of 80. So it's quite an increase as those ages are going up. Do you know, I was going to say, who discovered Alzheimer's, but do you know about the discovery of Alzheimer's at all?
I feel like this whole podcast is going to be me guessing things and then checking them with Rich.
I'm loving this game. Can you guess their name?
Yeah, look, go Ooh. For it. Guess it.
Oh, well, hang on, Rich. We just recorded another episode where I I tried to be as inclusive as possible and called someone Mr., Ms., and Mrs., forgetting Miss, and it was Miss. So,
no.
It was Doctor, actually.
Was it Doctor Alzheimer's?
She was Doctor. No, in the last episode.
In the last episode, it was Doctor. But was it Dr. Alzheimer's?
Alzheimer,
because it's theirs. Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, so it was oh my God, why do I do this? I never read the names beforehand. Yes, it was Alzheimer that discovered it in 1907 from an autopsy of a 55-year-old woman. She died from, progressive behavioral and cognitive disorder, it says. And apparently, upon the autopsy looking into this woman's brain, he found a few sort of odd things which we now know a lot more detail. We'll get to that in a little bit. I won't say exactly what it is unless you know what hyperphosphorylated means, Luke.
I don't. I suspect somebody in the room might know.
We can definitely go into that if I get a chance to put my science geek on. I'm very happy to see that.
You're on the right podcast, Rich.
Absolutely. We'll get there in just a sec. But yeah, so it was from 1907. So it's not something we've known about necessarily for all that long. Mm. Although I suppose 116 years? Maths, again. Mm. 116 years is a fairly long time.
It's longer than me.
That is, yes. Many things are longer than you, Luke. But I'll move on anyway. It's one of those situations where it takes quite a while for us to understand a lot of this stuff.
Yeah.
Because you've got to remember, right? 1907. our technology for sort of understanding what proteins were was not as great as it is now. It wasn't until, sort of closer to the 80s, late 80s, mid 80s, that we started to isolate and purify these sorts of things and really get to understanding what was going on with them. But again, as I've said, we'll get to that a little bit later. Shall we move on to the signs and symptoms?
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you know anything about, Luke?
Okay, so this would be something that I would have more understanding and experience of. So basically, the part of the reason why I was excited to do this episode is because, and with Rich, who is from Alzheimer's Society, was because my granny had Alzheimer's and dementia, and I did some fundraising stuff for Alzheimer's Society, and so have like a personal link to the charity and got support from there and all that kind of stuff. So this is a personal thing for me, and I experienced basically, the early signs and then the gradual sort of decline of my granny's cognitive ability. I would guess that sort of the early stuff might be, I will be completely guessing here because I don't have the best memory of all of these things and what order they appeared in. But I would say things like maybe mixing up words and sentences, losing your keys, like losing track of a sentence halfway through, that kind of thing, which to be fair are all things that I do as well. But like in a much greater degree and with sort of greater kind of... like it's all about one of these things is it's all about the kind of how frequently something happens, right? Would that be fair to say?
Yeah. I'm seeing nodding, so I'm going to say yes very confidently. You're kind of hitting on it there. Memory issues tends to be the first sort of thing, and you've also hit on another very important point, I think, which is that memory issues alone are not, if you've got memory issues, don't start worrying that you've got dementia. That there are many things that can cause memory issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Sure, and that's what I meant. I wasn't meaning to like sort of make fun there when I say I do
absolutely.
Things too. It's just like, sometimes one of the things that happened with my granny early on she would deny that she had anything because she would just say, oh no, this is just me, it's just older age, it's just normal things that happen, and that would cause her to be kind of, she was quite in denial about her situation.
You've hit on the issue here, why despite the fact dementia is the biggest killer in the UK, one of the top 10 killers in the world, while we've known about what we call the pathology, which is kind of the biology behind it, over 100 years, we've known about it even before that. Of course, people had what was called, because they were demented, right? That was it. And the reason we haven't made much progress is because no one's really talked about it, because they thought it was a natural part of aging, not a disease of the brain, because they were embarrassed about it. In the same way people were embarrassed about cancer, and it was the big C, we're still a little bit in that thing of like almost the big D where people don't want to talk about it. And in some cultures, they don't even have a word for it. So how could you possibly diagnose it? So I think the discussion we were just having there, where Luke, you were a little bit like, oh, I didn't mean to be disparaging about memory. You weren't at all. But it's that type of thing that stopped people talking about it. Mm. And even that's the biggest killer in the UK. It isn't on doorsteps always. And it really should be. And I think that's why opportunity to talk about it, like this podcast, and in print media recently, it's been getting more attention. It's so, so important because it is a disease. It is not a natural part of aging. We all forget things. But you're absolutely right. The key here is repetition. Does someone say to you, what are we doing tomorrow 20 times in a couple of hours in a day? It's not where did I put my keys or I can't remember where I parked my car. We have all done that. We will all do it again. And I think it is that kind of volume of repetition where you, okay, there is something here, go to the doctor. And again, even then, it doesn't mean anything until you get further tests. But I think this dialogue just between us shows how difficult it can be if it was a loved one going through this, when it's so much more harder to speak to them when there's emotion involved. And I think that's the crux of why this is really a really important conversation.
And out of interest, Rich, that I don't know how common it is. I'm sure you'll know more about this, to have the thing I described with my granny, where she was very in denial about the fact that this was happening to her, and she would sometimes not take her medication, and she wouldn't want to go to the doctors, and that was a real struggle. Out of interest, do you know, is that a generational thing? Is it part of dementia? Is it just a personality thing, and some people don't have that at all, and some people do have it? How often do you see that?
Yeah, I mean, the honest answer is probably all of those things. It is quite common. So my auntie and my granddad both had it, and they were both exactly the same, and then tried to hide it up. And actually, that's one of the things that we talk about, kind of people come removing themselves from social situations where kind of the symptoms become more obvious because they can't have a conversation maybe. And that is a thing that you see regularly. And that's why we need to talk about it and almost demystify and break down this stigma. And just compare to other diseases. I mean, cancer, for example, has a 28-day diagnosis target. In dementia, it takes 2 years.
Wow. Mm.
And this is the biggest killer in the UK. It takes 2 years to diagnose dementia. And part of it is people not wanting to come forward, not wanting to talk about it, not recognizing the symptoms. And that's not only families and people in society, it's also the healthcare system as well, which I'm sure we'll get onto. So it is a common thing. And it's one of the cultural barriers we need to overcome, that just like if someone finds a lump or if you break your leg, you go straight to the hospital. You don't try and hide it. Mm. At the moment, that has been a factor, but we are beginning to push past that, which is fantastic.
I think ultimately it kind of ties into as well this sort of stigma around mental health in general, right? I mean, you say if you find a lump or you break your leg, both of those things are physical things, right? I mean, it's very hard to lie to oneself about having a broken leg or having a lump, but it's much easier to trick yourself about something that isn't, how do we put it, that isn't necessarily as objectively there, right? Mm. I mean, memory already is something that can be kind of subjective. Our memories aren't, you know, 100% perfect as it is. And so when someone's saying to you, hey, don't trust your memory, you're forgetting things.
Sure.
It's in any situation, it's going to be really hard to, you know, kind of accept that, you know, it almost feels like being gaslit, except you're not being gaslit by someone else. Your memory is just not, you know, matching what you think it is.
I completely agree. And I think the improvements in our understanding of mental health, it has definitely opened up the conversation, which is fantastic. But we did a survey at Alzheimer's Society around what people were scared of, and people were scared of dying of cancer. Because, I mean, that is an awful disease, which, while we've made progress, is still very prevalent and still accounts for a lot of death. In the UK and around the world. But people were scared of living with Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Because, I mean, you typically live for 6 to 7 years. Typically, there are, of course, exceptions. You do forget things. You also become doubly incontinent. You don't recognize your children. And these are, like I say, these are really challenging, really difficult things that happen whether we talk about them or not. And I think what's happened, unfortunately, we haven't fronted up. And there's many reasons. And hopefully we'll talk about the progress research is making. That's my bias. I'm a director of research. So I think research is the answer, no matter what the question is. But we haven't always seen the progress that we're beginning to make now. And so I think we're beginning to tackle some of these really difficult questions and front up some of these challenging situations we're in a way we never, ever have before. I truly have been quoted recently saying, I think we're at a turning point, or maybe even the beginning of the end. And it's a long journey to take. It really, really is. But this is the beginning. I think we should all be incredibly excited. But we need to be honest about how difficult and challenging this disease is as well.
Absolutely, I agree. And what you're saying there about, you know, sort of research being the answer, could not agree more. Doesn't matter what the question is, obviously. You know, it's so true, especially because we've spoken about this on the podcast before. Uncertainty is such an issue when it comes to any health condition, you know, and there being uncertainty around Alzheimer's and dementia can make it even scarier. And the only way to sort of quell that uncertainty is further research, then outreach. But the work that, you know, you're all doing is helping that in sort of every way. But let's move on to maybe a few more of the symptoms. Luke, I think you hit on most of them already. And Rich, I could ask you to go through them, but I'm sure this is very easy for you. You know, confusion, disorientation, getting lost in familiar places. These are all sorts of things you might sort of experience. It says hallucinations as well. You know, low mood or anxiety. That was something that I wasn't aware of. That's sort of popped up a lot in what I was reading, that depression is, you know, quite strongly linked, which makes absolute sense. It's just something that I never personally considered because, you know, if I'm being perfectly honest with you, the closest I've ever gotten to, you know, someone with dementia is honestly, Luke, your granny, I think. Like, it's one person removed. I've never personally, you know, had someone experience that in my life. And so it's been very easy for me to just know very little. So I hope anyone that's listening that was in my position before is learning a bit more because, yeah, depression does seem to be quite strongly tied with, you know, Alzheimer's.
And it's interesting that because I think so much of the time as well, the conversation around Alzheimer's and dementia is focused on the external symptoms and not so much focused on what the experience would be like to actually have this disease. Yeah. It's so much focused on like, oh, what's it like living with somebody who has it? Or like, how can you help the person? And all that stuff is very, very valuable and it's the most obvious stuff. But also you're seeing like, your whole reality is constructed by your brain and your memory, right? And so you're like the other side of that, and why, Rich, is like you say, people are so terrified about the idea of living with it is because your whole, firstly, we might not even be able to comprehend what that would be like, but your whole world, the whole organ that constructs your experience of the world is breaking down. And it, yeah, like, and there are times in my experience with my granny where she was so scared and then equally there were times when she was sort of almost blissfully happy because she did, like, she lived in this exact moment, and if this exact moment was quite nice, then sometimes she would be having a good time. I had this wonderful, very sweet and kind of silly and fun memory, which obviously in some ways is not fun, but in some ways is fun, of walking her home from a fireworks show and like holding her hand and walking her home towards sort of the end of her life, closer to the end of her life before she went into care. And I walked her home arm in arm, holding her hand, and we got home to her house. And I'd been having a conversation with her the whole way home. And then she went into the kitchen and she said to my mum, "There's a very strange man who's just walked me home. He's very attractive. I think he might fancy me, but I don't know who he is." But she was really excited about the idea that, like, this man liked her, and she was like, "Oh, this is really nice and really sweet. And like, I don't know who he is, but ooh, this is nice." And those moments are like, while it's sad from the perspective of being the person with like not experiencing it, to be like, "Oh, this person's forgetting who I am," you know, that's also in some ways lovely. They're just living in the moment, and if the moment is nice, then they're having an okay time. I think would that be fair to say?
Yeah, and I think that's up until recently with the advances, it was all about helping people live the best life they possibly could, and that's different for every person. But it, definitely with the right care and support, we can help people still maintain a sense of independence during the early stages. And I think that's really, really important. I mean, at the Alzheimer's Society, we're really proud. We work a lot with people affected by dementia, and that's both the carers, which we haven't touched on yet as well. But of course, that's a huge thing with Alzheimer's disease and dementia, that you have the carer who has to support you during this as well. And the challenges that brings, but also the individual and what you can do. And we work with those groups. And one of the things they say to me a lot, and I'm mentored by a couple of families to make sure I really understand that they're kind of the real realities right now of living with this disease. And they say it feels like a really personal disease. I think it's because it does go, your very essence of who you are because it's a disease of the brain. And I think that that is really true. But there can be joy found. There can be moments of, and that you can still maintain something for a period of time. And I think if you get an early and accurate diagnosis, and I hope we'll talk about diagnosis and how bad that is, if you get that with the right care, you can have these moments, and they're so, so important. And it's going to actually become more important with the announcement about the treatments coming through, because these treatments are not cured. It's really important to say what's coming is not a cure, but they do slow down progression. So people will be living longer, hopefully, with this condition. So that care and quality of life, it will come into the conversation more and more.
Absolutely, yeah. No, I mean, we've gone over most of these sort of symptoms here. I mean, I've said sort of depression, anxiety, these sorts of things, hallucinations, personality changes, all of these sorts of things that we're kind of, I assume everyone is kind of aware of here, you know, sort of problems with speech and language. I mean, as a sort of degenerative brain disease, you can kind of guess the symptoms that you're going to start seeing, you know, as your brain starts to, you know, go through that. But yeah, let's move on to the diagnosis, I think, because, I mean, you know, yeah, it's something we talk about on the podcast a lot, I think. There's so many things that are sort of underdiagnosed, but particularly here, it seems that there's a real, real problem. It's very slow. I mean, the NHS, on the NHS website, which is, I do like going to the NHS for any time we do an episode on any sort of disease, disorder, anything like that, because I find it really interesting to know exactly what, you know, people are seeing when they search for this. Because whenever you search, you know, any sort of disease or anything, the first thing that comes up is the NHS, and they're the people that people trust to get advice from. And, you know, when the first thing that the NHS says about diagnosis is, you know, that, well, you know, Alzheimer's progresses slowly, and it can be difficult to recognize there's a problem, that's kind of a scary thing to see. Because, you know, I mean, ultimately, it goes on to say as well, I mean, as you've said as well, Rich, the key here is like sort of early diagnosis and really knowing what's going on as soon as possible. But yeah, it seems that it's just not really happening. I'm sure for a myriad of reasons you can sort of get into.
And I mean, this diagnosis, an early and accurate diagnosis, sometimes called a timely and accurate diagnosis, is kind of one of the key objectives of the Alzheimer's Society right now, because this is a key moment that currently we are not doing right and we're not doing well enough. And I think if you bring it back to that discovery, so as I mentioned, we'd known about dementia and Alzheimer's disease. We weren't calling it that for hundreds of years. We've seen people with symptoms and not quite understood what was happening, but it was just over 100 years ago now of Dr. Alzheimer, who discovered these tangles and these plaques building up in his patient's brain. So these were proteins that we all have that are really important. We don't quite know what they all do, but they help in kind of cell replication and in your metabolism. So we have these proteins, and one of them is called amyloid, and then that builds up around your cells, around your neurons, and it kind of creates this toxic environment which actually starts killing your neurons. And that's why you get the symptoms, because these tangles and these plaques start killing your neurons, your brain cells. And actually, by the end of Alzheimer's disease, your brain weighs 140 grams less than it did at the beginning. So that shows you the kind of damage that has been done. But we know these plaques start building up 20 years before symptoms, and that was a piece of Alzheimer's Society research. So we know in people's 40s and 50s these proteins are beginning to build up, and what we do right now is, of course, we wait until someone is experiencing these symptoms, we take them to a doctor, and actually, unfortunately, what we have at the moment, the first line, is kind of a written memory test, and of course that has pros and cons. I mean, often they're in English, there isn't one perfect test, there's lots of different ones, and so this all adds to that stat I mentioned earlier, where it takes 2 years on average to get a diagnosis, because you start with the memory test and then you go to referrals to try and identify these plaques and these tangles in people's brains. But we have some of the worst capacity for imaging in the Western world, so actually, we don't have the ability to do that. And it takes 2 years. And if you think you only live for 7 years, and 2 years is a long period of time where you don't know what's happening to your loved one. I mean, we hear stories about people saying they thought their partner was having an affair and they didn't understand why they were going out and not recognizing, and they have disturbed sleep, which also affects everything. And just knowing what you're facing together as a family can make all the difference. You know what symptoms to expect. And 2 years is unacceptably long. But I say that's, we do know about these plaques and these tangles that build up, and that is one of the keys to getting this diagnosis. And again, Alzheimer's Society research about 30 years ago kind of said that this protein amyloid that builds into these plaques, we kind of said this is a key player. And we gave that to the world. And that is certainly one that's certainly beginning to be proved true now.
You know, you're saying the sort of plaques build up of beta amyloid or amyloid beta. Yeah, and I've also seen that there's sort of links here to cardiovascular disease. And I'm just curious to know more about that, because I was kind of looking into it and it seems that we're not sure of too much of the sort of link there. But I've also seen that, you know, amyloidosis is, you can have it of the kidney and whatnot as well. I was curious to know about the link between those two things, if you could tell us anything.
Yeah, I mean, there's two ways of talking about that. One is about prevention as well. What's good for your heart is good for your head. So we know dementia, a number of the reasons why you can do those lifestyle prevention courses. So there's a great paper in The Lancet that kind of focuses on lifestyle factors. So again, we reckon like 20 to 30% of cases could be prevented by things that we know are good for us: smoking, not smoking, eating a bit less or in moderation, drinking in moderation, doing some exercise. There are a couple of specific ones for dementia. So there is links. Staying healthy, fit and healthy will help you prevent these conditions, not just cardiovascular and dementia, but also cancer. They're all very similar. One of the big links we know between cardiovascular disease and Alzheimer's disease is in the vasculature system. So it's how your body gets nutrients to a system and takes them away and gives it a blood supply. And certainly one of the subtypes of dementia, I've called, is actually vasculature dementia. So it is caused by, and again, it's that disease, the damage being done to your neurons is caused by the vascular system not working as it should do, which is something, of course, happens with your heart when you have a heart attack and things like that. So there are links there. And in fact, there are drugs that we can give people for heart disease that we're actually trying in Alzheimer's disease, and then for diabetes even as well, we're trying, because there are similarities between some of these conditions. We're trying to repurpose some of these drugs and see what effects they have, and some are looking really encouraging right now. And obviously, if it's already been signed up for another condition, it should be able to get to patients a lot quicker. So it's a really exciting avenue to look at.
Ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
What is this, Victorian England?
No, it is the present day. And can you hear that outside? It's the bin men. It's taking away all the people that haven't got their SciGuys Live in London tickets yet.
Put them in the trash, or put them at SciGuys.co.uk/trick-tickets so they can rectify their sins.
Not SciGuys.co.uk/trickets. There's no tricks here. There's only tickets. SciGuys.co.uk/tickets for SciGuys Live in London. What do they get when they go to SciGuys Live in London?
Well, they're going to get a live podcast recording. They'll get a Q&A with us lot. They'll get an interactive quickfire quiz.
You mean that they don't just need to scream at their screen for the answer and get some random prize? They might get an actual prize and scream at our actual faces?
That's exactly what I mean, Corey. Precisely, word for word, exactly what you said. So get your tickets now at sciguys.co.uk/tickets, not trickets. And remember that patrons get a special 20% discount.
But everyone can get the brand new never seen before merch that we'll have with us there. Isn't that right, Luke?
So I am told.
Let's get back to the show.
Goodness me, we've spent a long time with lots of energy.
No more energy. Just get tickets.
Get your tickets.
Yeah, and I feel like we've kind of started touching on this, the sort of risk factors. I mean, we've kind of covered the causes a little bit. Maybe we could go a little bit more in depth than that in a sec. Maybe as well, once we get to the sort of medications we've been looking into. I say we, as though it's been you and I.
You and I.
Yeah, Luke and I. We've
fighting the good fight.
Yeah, we've been doing this in the background, you know. But yeah, the sort of risk factors here. I mean, it should be clear, we don't know what triggers this disease. It's one of the we don't knows. It's something that comes up very often in the podcast. There's many things that we don't know in this world. This is one of them, but we're working on it. There are a few things that we know about. Age is, you know, obviously the primary one that everyone will tend to know. There's obviously also family history as well. So there's a genetic element as well, which on the Alzheimer's Society website, there's an entire page dedicated to the genetics of Alzheimer's. In fact, it's linked from the NHS website, I believe. It says, if you want more information, head there. And I had a look, and it is very good. No one's asked me to say this. It's just very useful. Just a lot of research just consolidated right there.
Well, our website is so good. I know going on to prevention, but when we're talking about symptoms, the Alzheimer's Society actually has something called a symptom checklist, which we developed with the Royal College of GPs. And one of the things about getting a diagnosis is the symptoms can be a bit vague and not quite clear. So we've got a whole list of symptoms signed off by the Royal College of GPs that we work with to try and say, well, this will help you have a conversation with your GP, who often face a whole myriad of diseases and don't have all the training in dementia that in an ideal world they would have, because it's just not possible for GPs to have all that. But this symptom checklist takes you through as a family member with your loved one. These are some of the things we are beginning to see, and that can really help. So our website, the Alzheimer's Society website, is a fantastic one to go to with lots of good information and useful things to use if that's helpful to people.
Yeah. So we've said age, sort of family history there as well. And then Down syndrome, that was something that I was surprised by. I had no idea. Basically, there seems to be a link between the changes in your sort of genetics that cause Down syndrome and Alzheimer's. So it would lead to an increased risk there. But yeah, I mean, I don't have a huge amount of information on that. Apparently, the Down Syndrome Association has more information on that. If you want to look into it, head injuries was something that I wasn't aware of as well.
Just before you leave genetic, I mean, just so genetics is a risk factor without any shadow of doubt. It is a smaller one than some other conditions and other diseases. Like it's like 1 to 3-4% as opposed to cancer, which is like 10 to 15%. And there's one particular gene where if you have the both copies from your parents, both give you this one variant of this gene, it is like a 20-fold more likelihood to get it, to get Alzheimer's disease, and particularly early onset as well. Early onset is definitely driven by that. And it's again due to that amyloid protein. It's around the genes that determine how your body breaks down that amyloid protein. And if it breaks it down in a way that makes that protein more likely to kind of group together and form those tangles, which then kind of get stuck in your neurons and kill your neurons, then of course you're more likely to get Alzheimer's disease, because it is the destruction of those neurons that kind of leads to the symptoms that we call dementia. So yeah, genetic component is a component, but it is a smaller one than for many other diseases of that.
Yeah, and I was saying head injuries I found interesting. I hadn't really, again, this is something that I've not really considered. It's been very much on the periphery of my life. And so it's illuminating to sort of see all of these sort of things. We said cardiovascular disease as well. And then a few other risk factors, apparently, hearing loss, untreated depression. But then I think also because Alzheimer's is sort of
comorbid.
Yeah, depression is common in those with Alzheimer's, so it could be sort of a bit of a confounding factor there. Loneliness or social isolation, apparently, as well, and a sedentary lifestyle. But I want to be clear here that these aren't necessarily causes. These are just things that are sort of risk factors in that if this is something if this is something that you have, there is maybe a higher likelihood. That's not necessarily a causal link in that direction. Mm. It could just be the related by other means. It could be a causal link in the opposite direction, any of those sorts of things.
It's like when you look at people who play tennis and it's like, oh, people who play tennis live longer. And then it turns out, well, it's just because people who play tennis are richer.
Oh, yeah, that was the whole thing with... Yeah, so I actually want to debunk something here. Oh, this whole thing, don't drink a glass of wine a day. Don't do that. Don't do that if you want to live longer. It's just rich people do that. Rich people live longer. Whenever you see a study that says, people that do this thing, this indulgent thing, or this thing that you think might not be healthy, live longer, they're rich. That's what it is, usually.
This is hopefully where Rich doesn't tell us that red wine is a great, thing for delaying Alzheimer's. That would be dreadful.
I won't mention red, should I mention my three mansions and my chateau in France? keep it with them. I don't have three mansions or a chateau. I want to make it super clear.
He has four. Okay. Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. No, I think that's a really important point you make, though, around the causal kind of, is it correlation or causation? Is a really important question that actually academics and scientists, we argue about it all the time, because it's very difficult to remove all variability. So when you're looking for something, normally two or three things are changing. And how do you say which thing was the thing that changed everything? So it is really hard. And all we can say is you need to be open about it. These are the things that didn't change in this study, and these are things that did. So we cannot say, for example, that a direct correlation between A and B was definitely a thing. So there are many other things going on as well. But yeah, it's a really important point. And just to highlight again, hearing is a really great one. We don't know if there's something biological around someone losing their hearing that links Alzheimer's disease and dementia. Like, there may be a biological link, and I've seen papers and people think that. It could also be because when you can't hear a conversation so well, you remove yourself from it, and it links to social isolation, and you're not engaging in conversation, you're not keeping yourself active, you're not engaging in things because you can't hear and you can't follow. So is it the social isolation aspect? Is it biological? Is it a mixture of both? And we don't know, so we can't say what it is about hearing loss is doing it, but we can say that on average, if you took 100 people and there were more people with the hearing loss, more of those were going to develop it than not. But we don't know why, and it's a really important thing to say that we don't know why.
I think it's really interesting as well what you say about the genetic variability being comparatively low, because I think that, I mean, you know, having had my granny have Alzheimer's, I didn't really look much into the science of Alzheimer's. I looked into how to be a good grandson to someone with Alzheimer's, right? That's all I really cared about. And I imagine, like, the second worry, like, you got the first worry, this person I love is not okay. And then I would imagine the immediate next worry is, I'm going to get this, because they, you would make the assumption that there's some, there's like a very strong genetic correlation, or you at least worry that there is, and that's like that, you know, worry number two is, oh no, and this is going to happen to me. So it's good to know that it's, well, it's good to sort of broadcast that, in other than in the specific case of this one gene, or these two copies of this one gene, there's not as much of a correlation as there is with other diseases.
Yeah, absolutely. And there has, of course, been a story. I mean, Chris Hemsworth, the actor, recently came out and talked about how he'd found out he had two variants of this one gene that is increasing his risk. And that was one of the reasons why he's kind of decided to, I believe he was taking a bit of a break and looking at other things, spending time, because he did sign that. And of course, we're not quite at this stage in dementia yet. We haven't had enough investment in research for decades. We've been far behind other diseases. But in cancer, for example, we always hold up someone like Angelina Jolie, who found out she had a BRCA mutation, which is one of the genes. And she actually took preventative surgery to be able to do that before she even had it, just based on that. But we're not quite there in our research and understanding to be able to do anything like that. But it is important to know it's not a huge thing. But if you do have it, there is also, you need some, we call it kind of genetic counselling, talking about what that means for you and what things you can do. And it's a really important topic to talk about. I think people are worried about it, and it is important to know there is a small percentage, but there is a risk, and you can find out on your own, but it's not a general screening, and there are things that you should know about if that is the case.
I think as well, I mean, a few things actually. I mean, first off, I feel like we generally, people would sort of view medicine as not finished, but we generally know a lot about most things, right? So I imagine most people would assume, okay, you just go to the doctors and they just give you the test for this thing, because we've got a test for all of these things. But yeah, no, I think it's very important to let people know that there's not always just an easy, all right, go in, check you, and then you're done. For lots of things, it can be more complex than that. I mean, for one thing, it's, you know, for one reason, it's biology. Biology is ridiculously complex.
I'd almost say the more we find out, the less we realize we know. I think like all the low-hanging fruit has been answered. But I mean, we don't know how the brain works.
Right? Yeah,
we don't know the different parts of function in the brain. We don't know how this works. So we are trying to solve a disease of a build-up proteins, which we don't know all of what they do in a healthy individual. And we're trying to modify these proteins' behavior in someone who has a disease of a protein we don't even know what it does. I mean, actually, if you think we can even do that at all, modify something we don't know what it does in a healthy individual and modify it in an unhealthy individual, the fact that we can even do that now is mind-blowing. But there's so much that we don't know. And again, go back to my research is the answer. It does take time. It does take money. But I think you've seen in other conditions and in other areas, the more investment, the more time you spend in research, in science, we will find out the answers. And I truly believe research and science leads to the greater good for all humanity. Is my throwaway comment for you.
Well, I was going to say, actually, because this is something I've mentioned maybe a couple times before, but I did biotech at uni, and there was this thing that kept on happening every single year, where one year they'd say, okay, cool, we've reached the end of this, we don't actually know anymore, I can't teach you anymore, because no one knows, we're still working on it. And then the next year, they'd come out and say, so what we taught you last year was maybe a bit wrong, not on purpose. We just discovered some new stuff. And so now it's on the syllabus. And we're like, oh, okay, so you're teaching us something that you didn't know about until, okay, good, great. And that's the thing, like with the right funding, it can move incredibly quickly. Like, I mean, I did biotech, it's microorganisms and whatnot for in medicines and all this sort of stuff. Like, it can move so quickly if you put the right funding behind it.
I completely agree. So I did chemistry undergraduate, and basically every year they said, by the way, we lied to you last year. One, because we didn't think you could cope with the truth. You can't handle it. to butcher a quote there. But and then they said also, we found out something new. So everything kind of changed. And I think that is completely true. I mean, when I finished my PhD, within 2 years of me leaving the lab, new technologies came out, something like called CRISPR, which means you can now modify genes and genetics in a far more precise way. I mean, I'd roughly cut something and throw some stuff that's some genes in the dish and hopefully something would stick. And within 2 years, that was so old school.
Are you joking?
It was deemed barbaric. And so suddenly you have this precise way of doing it.
Can I just say, sorry, I went to uni and CRISPR was just a thing. That was just a thing. I never considered having to do anything before that. Good Lord. Oh my God.
You closed your eyes, you hope for the best, and you threw some stuff in a dish and you just hope something would stick somewhere. But yeah, it's 2 years. And then suddenly my PhD, because I was out of research 2 years and hadn't adapted and changed, it was kind of done. That was it. You pick a new career, and I have That's the best bad. Job in the world, so I'm very lucky. But if I wanted to get back into research, that would have been hard.
Yeah, and I can imagine. And it just I mean, something from when I was at uni, there were these sort of living robots. We did an episode on these sort of like sort of biological sort of living robots that were kind of being spoken about as, hey, here's a thing that we can maybe do. We're kind of just starting to figure this stuff out. And then maybe last year or this year, we did a whole episode on them because we've come that far, you know, since I've left uni. Things can move quickly, you know, things really can move quickly. But it's all about the proper funding and time, yeah.
And I think one of the things that's really important is we need to take the understanding we get and we need to make sure it benefits people. And I think that kind of implementation is one of the things that's really challenging. So we kind of talked about the diagnosis and these build up of these proteins in people's brains. Now in a specialist center in the UK right now, you can do a blood test, so we don't have just the memory tests. Normally we have a blood test, but they're not available outside these specialist centers. You have to wait 2 years for either a brain scan to fight see the plaques in an image, or a lumbar puncture. We kind of take liquid from someone's spinal column and then you find the proteins in that. So at the moment you have to wait for one of these really specialist brain scans where we've got less than 100 of them in the country, or you have to have a lumbar puncture, which is a little bit invasive, but it's certainly possible. But you could do a blood test, and certain centers here, we do blood tests, but they're not, the technology hasn't gone so far to be adapted to the NHS. So it can be used in every day in a rainy, I don't want to pick town because whoever's from that town, a rainy place somewhere in England.
Say Dundee.
We'll pick Dundee and then make an email to you. So in a rainy day in Dundee, you can also, someone, a non-specialist in dementia with non-specialist equipment, can also do a blood test, which is cheap and quicker than anything we have at the moment. But there's not quite as much incentive to take this cutting edge blood tests and then roll them out across the NHS once you've kind of developed it. But Alzheimer's Society, in partnership with Alzheimer's Research UK and the UK government, recently got £5 million. We applied for a grant and we got £5 million from the postcode, the People's Postcode Lottery. And that is to do exactly that. We've got these blood tests, but they're not everywhere. Over the next 5 years, can we roll out these blood tests to really tackle that diagnosis problem and bring it down from 2 years to something that's much better for people? And that kind of implementation science is really key. Taking that knowledge and making it benefit people now, not waiting. And that's something that we definitely in the Alzheimer's Society are really keen to do more.
Well, I think if this could probably help people understand this. I mean, if we look at sort of what happened with the pandemic, you know, how we managed to get, and obviously it's a very different situation because we knew about coronaviruses, we had a lot of the infrastructure already there. There was a lot of things that we already knew, so it's not exactly the same thing. I'm not trying to say that, but my point is that, you know, there was that sort of lag period where we were trying to figure things out, and then it was rolling it out. So, you know, we had the rapid tests, we had you know, the vaccines being rolled out really quickly. It's a case of like actually, yeah, as you're saying, actually implementing it. And I kind of wonder if, you know, because this is such a big killer, and one of the reasons that it kind of falls behind is that people view this sort of as an old person's disease, and we don't tend to respect the elderly maybe as much as we should. Do you know what I mean? And so really more funding should be going into this, but it's maybe not, just because how some people view, you know, the elderly as a group.
I think you're right. I think there's definitely something about that. I mean, the biggest risk factor for that and other, for dementia and others is aging. I think that's definitely a factor is why people don't do it. I think the fact that there hasn't been much investment, so you haven't had that kind of progress and breakthroughs and that people can hook onto and talk about. I think when you get progress and you get breakthroughs, you can talk about it as well, because I think that helps. But you're right. I think there is an element of that. I mean, in 2012, the UK government spent 25-ish million pounds on dementia. I mean, because it's one of the biggest killers. The cost of the economy is in the tens of billions of pounds. It should have got more investment over a longer period of time. But without the investment, doesn't come the breakthroughs. Without the breakthroughs, doesn't come the comms and the media and the know-how. Yeah. And you don't believe. So it's kind of like this circle where if you can get enough research and you can prove you can do something about this condition, I think that helps, even though some of these conditions, do target the elderly more. And unfortunately, that doesn't seem to be as politically attractive to focus on that, even though it's the biggest killer in the UK.
Yeah, it's like getting over that sort of activation energy there, just like, you know, getting just enough done that we can kind of snowball it and push it forward. I mean, we've been speaking about sort of the risks and, you know, how to sort of tackle this as a sort of larger problem, but I think maybe if we kind of hone in a little bit more on the sort of treatment and management, I think maybe if we talk sort of about the medication first, and then we could talk about sort of the other options as well, because I feel like, you know, the medication isn't something people necessarily understand, and also it's something that's been in the news quite a lot recently as well. I mean, we could talk about the sort of ACHE inhibitors or memantine. Oh my gosh, why do I do this to myself and not read the words thoroughly beforehand? But the most recent one, I think, is it donimab?
Donimab,
which is kind of has been in probably sort of the news recently. It's one you've probably heard about the most recently. It's a monoclonal antibody, and the idea is that it's supposed to sort of clear those sort of amyloid proteins from the brain, right? The research has been coming out quite a lot recently, but maybe you could share some more about that.
I mean it's a brilliant story, and it's why we're also excited that we believe we're at a turning point in our fight against Alzheimer's disease. But I guess really I'll start with a thank you to Luke. I mean, Alzheimer's Society research funded 30 years ago and continuing to fund research into this. And we found 30 years ago, we developed something called the amyloid hypothesis. And this is where we funded someone who then was just Dr. Hardy, is now Sir Professor John Hardy. And we also put a notice out in our newsletter saying, if you've got a family history, please do come forward. We want to pair you up with a researcher. So we funded a bit of research in partnership, and we brought an incredible woman called Cameron Jennings together with John. And what they developed was something called the amyloid hypothesis. So it's people like you, Luke, that did fundraise for us and did go out and do memory walks and did get your fundraising packs and do other things for us. They've been funding this world-class research for 30 years. And it has taken 30 years from us funding this piece to today. But that amyloid hypothesis said amyloid's a key player. This is a key protein that is building up people's brains. If only we could remove it, we think that would make a difference. And we gave that to the world to go and fund studies in it. And what these treatments do is they remove amyloid from people's brains. They remove it, and amyloid builds up in stages. So it kind of goes from this single protein almost to kind of monomers, and then you kind of get these small tangles and bigger tangles, and then finally these plaques. So it kind of builds up in stages. So there's been a number of treatments to remove this protein building up at different stages. But it removes it from the brain really, really quickly. And what we have seen in these studies is the fact that for the first time ever, people in this treatment, it removed the amyloid protein from the brain really quickly, really, really quickly and really effectively. And that led to patient benefit. It slowed down the progression. It did not stop it. It did not reverse it. These are not cures. But by removing protein from the brain as quickly as donanemab and just before that lecanemab did, it leads to patient benefit. And we call these disease-modifying treatments. They actually target the disease and they slow down progression. What we had before is what we call symptomatic treatments. If you think of a symptomatic treatment, you can think of if you break your leg and you have a painkiller. That is incredibly useful and it helps you kind of manage, but it doesn't fix your broken leg. So we've had symptomatic treatments before. You mentioned memantine, we've got tenapizil and others as well that are really important, but they don't carry on working and you're still progressing. Your disease is still progressing. Your brain is still being damaged. Your neurons have been damaged, but your body's kind of mitigating. These are disease modifying. They slow down the progression of the disease, and they slowed it down by different percentages depending on, you can again look at the subgroups who responded in different ways. But between kind of like 27 to kind of 36% was the average we got given. And they showed wow. things like carer, quality of life increasing, showed that someone could carry on doing their hobbies, managing their finances, talking about current affairs for longer. So it's not as far as we want to get, because I think it's showing a slowing of about 7 months-ish on average. But again, it's the first time we've ever shown that you can treat the disease and you can slow it down. And that's why we're really excited.
I've got some of the stats in front of me here. I mean, I can just rattle some of them off. It says that it slowed how fast memory and thinking get worse by more than 20%. This was from a trial, by the way, as well. So bear in mind that these sort of numbers, you can't take them as absolute fact because, you know, we have to repeat this a number of times with a number of different groups of people. You know, for example, in this trial, 91.5% of the participants were from a white background, it says. This is actually on, from a white background, it says. So, you know, again, not to put a hamper on this, this is incredible, but there's still more research to be done. And with more research, we could see even better results as well. You know, this is sort of first step here.
You just highlighted a really key, and there were many things, and we could talk for days about these breakthroughs, but 90% of everything we know about dementia is based on 10% of the population. And that's because most of the people in the trials are of white European heritage. And there may well be differences, and it's something we desperately need to address. And there will be differences. So it's something we absolutely need to look at. So this is a big breakthrough, and hopefully it changes the narrative. We can do something, but there's a lot of things we don't know. And there were some groups that responded better, some less as well. For example, if you've had a stroke or if you're on blood thinners, potentially you shouldn't go on these treatments. Also, these treatments are only effective when you are diagnosed at the early stages.
Early onset,
so
yeah. Called
MCI. Mild cognitive impairment, which is a pre-dementia diagnosis. It means you're kind of not performing as you'd expect, but you haven't yet progressed into what we deem Alzheimer's disease or early Alzheimer's disease. So these treatments are incredible. They do seem to slow it down. It's important we let MHRA and NICE, the two regulatory authorities, to look at these, as you rightly say, look at the data that's available and make the right decisions. And we believe they're going to be looking and making decisions towards the end of next year. And it's only after that they'd be available in the NHS. But the data we've seen does look good. We are really kind of encouraged by the data we've seen. But yeah, there's a lot of hurdles and steps to overcome first before patients get.
I mean, it is really encouraging. I mean, it's delay in the progression of Alzheimer's by 4.5 to 7.5 months over the 18 months of the trial. You've got, what else does it say here? 40% reduction in the decline of their ability to 40% reduction in the decline of their ability to carry out daily activities.
40%, wow.
40% reduction. Yeah. This is brilliant.
Because this is the thing, is that this could be, like, presumably, obviously the goal eventually is a cure, right? That would be the wonderful holy grail. But the other thing is that especially in patients who are older, and because it does correlate with age, like there's still something amazing to delay it, because the reality is that you could end up not dying of Alzheimer's even though you have it, because you're older and you die of something more naturally, and up until your death, you know, you're still able to hold conversations, and that's a much nicer way to go.
Yeah. And there's a big debate, kind of, because some of the effects seen in the trials were small, and so there's been a big debate around clinical meaningfulness, as in what difference does it make. Yes, your biomarkers gone. So a lot of the people after 12 to 18 months in the trial, we'd remove so much amyloid from their brains they weren't even eligible to enter the trial anymore. So you have to be diagnosed early and with high amyloid, because these drugs remove amyloid. There's no point giving someone an amyloid removing drug if you don't have the amyloid plaques in your brain. But within 12 to 18 months, most people actually were suddenly not eligible for the trial, so they're removed. But does that mean they have a better quality of life? Was a very valid, really fair question to ask. You've removed the proteins, but does that make a difference? And I think what donanemab showed by that 40% slowing of their ability to do everyday functions, and that was things like driving, managing finances, talking about everyday affairs, doing your hobbies, that's meaningful, right? And even if it's only a period of months, that is maybe months where you're still able to do these things, and that matters a lot to individuals. And the same way, like kind of patient choice in cancers and other diseases, you can have very expensive treatments that have really bad side effects, but they keep you alive for longer And some people choose that option. And I think these treatments, while they have side effects that we'll get to, I think it's really important to say that it does appear they make a difference. And we need to let the authorities look at that. But the evidence so far looks really, really encouraging. And yeah, we should be really, really excited. And I think an analogy we kind of use on these DMTs to help explain them again is, if you think about a fire in a building, you have a spark that starts the fire, then you have the fire raging, and then you have the kind of smoke that kind of builds up. Mm. The symptomatic treatments we had, like opening the window and then sending smoke out, definitely effective, did something, but the fire was still raging, the spark was still going. What amyloid may be, and this is conjecture, we don't know this, amyloid may be the spark. So amyloid's not the only player. Amyloid may just be the start of a chain reaction, is an hypothesis. So there are other proteins like tau that build up as well that we could talk about. But we think amyloid may be one of the worst ones. At the moment, what we're doing is we're waiting until someone has built up this protein over 20 years, as I mentioned, until their neurons are starting to die so much so they get symptoms. And then what we're doing is we're dampening down the spark. Now, that may get to the stage where we can make it chronic. As you mentioned, something you can live with and die with, but not die from. What if we give it a bit earlier? What if we clear it even faster? Can we get, it's not curing it, but it could be slowing it down to the point where you'd be 150 before you died of Alzheimer's dementia. And you're going to have other problems as well by that stage. So that's really exciting. But for me, where my head goes in a let's be crazy and think about the future and how great this could be. We know it takes 20 years for this protein to build up in your brain. And we know we can remove this protein so quickly. In 12 to 18 months, it's not really even detectable almost in some instances. What if we start giving the treatment even earlier? What if we start giving it before symptoms? So at the moment, we're waiting until your brain is damaged until we remove this protein. And that's not possible because these treatments are hard to give and they have side effects. I'm sure we'll talk about them in a sec. But that's the possibility now. So this story of you go to the GP and they say, oh, we're not sure you've got any problems, come back in 6 months. And you go back again and say, no, I really think I've got a problem. They go, no. You do a written test and the results aren't quite clear. And you go back again. Then you get referred for brain scan, it takes 12 months. And then finally, after 2 years, you get a diagnosis of Alzheimer's dementia. And then you start talking about care homes and other things. What if in this future world, at the age of 40, you go for your 40-year-old checkup, you have a blood test. That blood test comes back in a week, says you have high amyloid, and then they give you an amyloid-removing drug and removes it all within 12 months, and no one outside that room even knows you've ever had that diagnosis, and you're carrying doing your job as a brain surgeon. Because that's a future we can now start talking about because of these treatments. Now, these treatments are not that really important, but they are showing a path. They're showing a direction of travel. And we should all be incredibly excited about it.
I want to put this in some context for people as well. I mean, if we look at something like HIV and AIDS, right? You know, if we go back maybe 40 or so years, that's something that at the end to it was almost inconceivable. And now we've got PrEP. And what do you do if you're at high risk? Okay, well, I'll just go and get PrEP and I'll be on PrEP. There you go. Sorted. You know, like this is something that is certainly possible, right? That was a basically 40-year span almost from sort of what is this thing to, okay, sorted, more or less. I mean, not to sort of diminish HIV and AIDS. Obviously, it's still a very serious problem in many parts of the world that is largely down to access more so than, you know, the drugs themselves. But this is something that is very much possible with, you know, research. And
I think HIV is a brilliant comparison, and we're using a lot in the field now in conferences. We kind of talk, and I think you're right. One of the things we look at is basically society stood up now and said, this is unacceptable. This is unacceptable. We need to do something about it. And that kickstarted a lot of research and a lot of emphasis, which is fantastic. The first treatments were not great. You had to take 20 pills sometimes in a day, right, to try and manage it. And that's not feasible. And access in Western countries to non-developed countries is also something which is a big issue, as you rightly highlighted. So we're going to face some of the challenges, but these are the first treatments. They are not the end goal. They are just the first step. But you're absolutely right. We've done it in other conditions. We will do it in dementia and Alzheimer's.
Can I just ask quickly, on the build-up that you're talking about that takes 20 years or so, when you're seeing that, does that mean that this person is going to develop Alzheimer's and dementia, or is it like a percentage, like a high risk factor?
Yeah, it's a really great question. And yeah, it's not definite. It is a risk factor. So you do have people with high amyloid that don't have Alzheimer's and dementia, and you have people with low that do. So it isn't as simple. But in my head, it's almost like a statin, right? So, I mean, do you have high cholesterol? Yes. are you guaranteed to have a heart attack or stroke? No, it's a risk factor. It increases. So you take a statin and that lowers it, and hopefully you won't then get it. These aren't, but again, this is the future, because these treatments are not a statin. They're not an at-home pill. They have side effects. But that's the type of thing. It's an increased risk factor. It's not definite. But if you had a treatment that was at home with limited side effects, it's something you could modify. But it's a really important point. No, you have people that have high amyloid and don't have Alzheimer's disease.
I think that's something that is I can't even say universally true, because it defeats the point of what I'm saying. That's something that's relatively universally true across biology, that nothing is terribly universally true, right? You know, if you, I almost always
it is
say
a universal truth that nothing is universally true.
Like, genuinely though, I mean, I am always terrified to make any statement on this podcast, because I know that someone's going to, when it comes to biology, because I know someone's going to come in and say, well, actually, here's the case where that's not, yeah, absolutely. And we don't understand it.
During your PhD viva, that's the thought. You never say anything with certainty. There's always a chance that someone will do something, say, on average, or often you find this, or sometimes it's, you never say this is their case, because there'll always be that one time. I completely agree. The safest thing in research, say what we think now, or what is we think may be true. And then, you know, that's also true, because as we learn more, right, there's the whole, I'm reading a book now about kind of discovery of opening up the atoms, and how we thought, oh yeah, this, we've definitely found everything we need to. And oh god, no, we never found more. And then the accelerator particles got
it just keeps going,
faster,
going
better, and then the muons, and then everything. So maybe, yeah, so you can never say anything with certainty. But that's what I think, one of the great things about science, we're always checking, always checking ourselves again. Always, there's nothing that stays, because we're always learning out more and challenging it. And I think that's why you can trust research. We will get things wrong, but often research highlights that we've got it wrong, and then we come back around. So we make mistakes all the time, but hopefully we're open about it, we're honest about it, and we have that dialogue.
See, I like to think of it as, you know, yeah, we've got stuff wrong, sure, but we're more right now. Being wrong before is actually a great thing, because now we know that's wrong. Cool, now we're closer to the not wrong thing. Will we ever fully get to the most not wrong, the most like correct thing? Maybe not, but that doesn't matter. We're getting less wrong every day.
Absolutely. And I thought that about the clinical trials in dementia. So there wasn't much investment. Like I say, the UK government invented in the 20s in 2012. So, but, and we did a load of trials, and people say those trials failed. Well, actually, those trials didn't hit the main endpoint, but we learned loads. In fact, one of the things we learned from the Alzheimer's trials that remove amyloid is we learn it's not actually the total amount of amyloid you remove. We think it's how quickly you remove it. So you have to get down to a certain level within a kind of a 6 month time frame. When you look at it like that, all the trials I've ever done that look like they've succeeded. But we didn't always, some populations did, some populations didn't. And we weren't designing the drugs to do that always. So actually, yeah, we were always learning. And it's actually because we learned from then that we managed to design these drugs and these trials to be a bit better. And while the next ones will get even better still. So I completely and utterly agree. Yeah, we're always learning. We're making mistakes. We're learning from them. There's no such thing as a wasted experiment, because either we're sense checking something else that definitely works so we can all be confident, or we're challenging something and trying to learn.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, and those side effects, I think we should definitely talk about those, because, you know, I don't want to give the idea that, you know, this is a miracle cure sort of thing, you know, but there are some side effects I've got in front of me here. There were 3 deaths attributed to brain, or related to brain swelling, and 1.6 participants had serious symptoms relating to brain swelling, it says here. And the 3 deaths was 0.4% of the participants. So 0.4%. I mean, if we look at the sort of mortality rate of dementia as well, that is, you know, it's one of the biggest killers in the UK. And that's not to say that, you know, these side effects are absolutely okay, but we need to understand what we're looking at here, right? If you look at, say, chemotherapy, right, that is incredibly aggressive. You know, all of the therapies we've got for cancer are incredibly aggressive, and we wouldn't think of using them on something like, you know, say, the common cold. But when you weigh that sort of thing up, it is a different story. But how do I put this? I feel like people take side effects and think that's 100% chance and I'm terrified and it's a bad thing. But that's not necessarily the case. And also, again, these are the first trials. You know what I mean? Understanding that these side effects can happen, understanding how to mitigate them is exactly what, you know, these sort of further trials are going to be about. You know, so it's not necessarily this big, scary, bad thing to see these side effects. It's a good thing that we're seeing them now so that we can, you know, work to stopping them or understanding them better.
I mean, it's really important we raise them. I think what we don't want to do is talk about these treatments being a miracle cure. They're not. They are not a cure at all. So it's really important that we talk about them. And you're right. So there's a couple of challenges with these treatments. One, they're an IV infusion. So you have to go into a hospital for 2 or 4 weeks and have a drip set up. And that's not easy for a family to navigate. Then when you have them, absolutely right, you get something called ARIA. And this is the brain swelling or the microbleeds. And we're not entirely sure why you have them. Some people get the amyloid buildup in their blood vessels. And then, of course, if you remove it, your blood vessels become a little bit leaky. And that's where you get that. So we're not entirely sure, honestly. But about a third of people got ARIA to some degree. And as you rightly say, about 1.6% of people then got serious side effects. And they need to come off the treatment immediately. And there were some deaths on this. And every drug I know, or almost every drug that has side effects, and these are really serious. And they, like I say, there were 3 deaths. For lecanemab, the other drug that did something similar that we found out about 8, 9 months ago, there was actually more deaths in the control arm than the active drug arm when they were announced in San Francisco. But since then, there have been more deaths of people on the drug. So absolutely, that is something that needs to be monitored. And it needs to be monitored with an MRI. And again, in the UK, we don't have enough capacity to do a brain scan to check for ARIA every 2 or 3 months as recommended in these trials. So again, there's a capacity thing there. So we need to talk about that and we need to be honest. But as you mentioned, chemotherapy is there. I mean, chemotherapy is based on mustard gas, right? I mean, there's remember that. So, and when you first gave them, there wasn't any anti-sickness treatments. The first mastectomies remove women's shoulder blades at the same time as removing their breast tissue. And again, you look now and think, God, that was crazy. Why did we do that? And I'm sure we'll look back in 10 years' time and say, why did we give those awful treatments? We've got these amazing ones now in dementia and Alzheimer's. I truly believe we will, but we have to be honest. And it's about, I think it's about making the allowing the patient to make an informed decision. Some people on chemotherapies go on chemotherapy to get 18 months of life. And they go through that. Some side, I don't want that. I'm going to go traveling for 6 months and do that. That's the patient's choice that they get to make. And the same here. You can take this treatment. You may get 7 more months of better quality life that enables you to do things like hobbies, manage finances, drive, the things that they say in the lecanemab. You may get that. And you'll have to do all these things. But there's a 1.6% chance you'll get brain swelling. And that can lead to fatalities if it's not monitored. What would you rather do, patient? What would you give the power to them? Let them make that choice and be open and honest with them. I think that's where we should be. And just a final thing, these are trials. They will go to the MHRA and NICE, which are the kind of independent regulatory authorities that will look at the data, way more data than we've seen. And anything that MHRA and NICE sign off mean they have looked at all the data more than we have available and said it is safe and it's effective. That doesn't mean it's risk-free. But we need to allow those kind of authorities to look at the data, make those decisions so that everyone can be confident in this treatment. But you're absolutely right to raise them, and we should talk about them more and be more open about them.
Yeah, and I mean, I think sort of before we finish, it'd be really good to talk about sort of other treatments, sort of management rather than sort of more medical sort of treatments. Or medical, is that what I mean? Medicines? Is that the word that I'm looking for? I think it is, yes.
Pharmacological?
That's a much better word. That's a much better word. Where'd you pull that one from?
My voice box.
Very good job.
It's a great voice box you have.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
But yeah, no, I think it's a really important thing to talk about, you know, that it's not just about sort of medical treatments. There are, it is about management. I mean, look, you would know that sort of from firsthand experience.
Yeah, and I wonder, like, what the thing that we were sort of, whether we were taught or like told, or generally was just about, don't worry too much about constantly reminding my granny of the things she's forgotten. If she thinks that I'm just a bloke who's hanging out in the house, and but she's perfectly comfortable and she's happy and she doesn't feel scared, there's no point reminding her every 5 minutes that, no, I'm your grandson, and then stressing her out all the time that she can't remember anything. That, because there's no, like, there is no point. She'll forget it in a few minutes. I mean, maybe that was wrong. That was just the strategy we took a lot of the time, was basically like, don't stress her out reminding her she's got dementia all the time. Just if she's happy and she's comfortable, just keep going. And if that means she's existing in a sort of slightly, I don't know, like a slightly false reality, but it's a nice reality, then that's kind of fine. I mean, that was our strategy. What do you think, Rich?
Yeah, I mean, every situation and family is different. I hear that a lot. And the advice I get is, it's all about ensuring that person has a good quality of life. And they're going to have to be changes as the disease progresses. I mean, this is a terminal illness, and we've heard about that. So it's whatever works for you and your family. And I do hear quite often, don't correct an individual if they're saying something, if they're not distressed and they're comfortable. I think it's different if they were distressed by a stranger being in their room.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
And if they are comfortable with that person there, then absolutely I would encourage people to go along with it, because that then means you can move on from that conversation. You don't have to talk about the illness or the disease or what they can't do. You can focus on what they can do. Yeah. I think that's a much more positive conversation. So my personal opinion, from my personal experience, absolutely. I think it varies depending on families. And I think you do whatever you need to do to cope in that situation. But no, I think that's a good strategy. And I've certainly heard many people say they've adopted it.
But on the flip side, actually, my granny sometimes loved relearning that she had grandchildren over and over again. Like, she genuinely, that gave her so much joy every time. She thought, for example, she thought I was my granddad. Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, no, granny, I'm your grandson. I'm your daughter's son. And she'd be like, oh. And be so happy relearning that. Mm. And like the joy, as if she'd never heard that before and it was her first time hearing it, was actually really lovely as well sometimes. So both sides of it work, just depending on how they respond.
One of the things I've found amazing has been research, and people ask me this a lot, like when someone enters the late stage in the care home and they're not quite verbal, and they go there and they hold their hand, and they read to them, like, is that worth it? Does that make a difference? And there's definitely studies saying that, like, people's heart rate slowed down and they release relaxation hormone. Like, there is responses to these individuals when they have a loved one, a care one, looking after them. That makes a difference. They may not be aware of it like kind of on one level, but on the deep conscious state, they are relaxing, their bodies are changing and responding to that. And I think it's a really important thing to all of us be aware of. That makes a difference.
This is kind of related to an episode that's going to be coming out soon for us, but I was looking into sort of some Montessori stuff and I found a lot of research on implementing Montessori methods into sort of care for those with dementia. And if you don't know what Montessori is, it's a sort of method of generally education, but it can really exist in sort of all forms of your sort of life raising children, where you kind of let them have their own sort of agency and let them direct their sort of learning. And in the case of dementia, it's a sort of similar thing wherein it's allowing people to have their agency. Because I feel like what often happens is when you see someone sort of, you know, struggling with memory and struggling with sort of what you see as sort of objective reality, the people's sort of automatic response is almost to be like, oh, well, you're struggling with reality. This reality is objective. You can't care for yourself. I'm going to take away your agency in some way and make you conform to what I feel like you should be conforming to, kind of what you're saying there, Luke, about sort of like, you know, being like, no, you're wrong here, this isn't right. But if the person isn't distressed, as you've been saying, like letting them have that agency, letting them exist in sort of joyful moments just seems to make more sense. And, you know, I mean, you can check the links in the description. There's a good few papers on Montessori based dementia care, and it does seem to have sort of benefits, you know, again, focusing on the individual as an individual, you know?
Yeah, I think it's really important. Like I said, I think it's really important. It'll be different for everyone. I mean, we've talked about Alzheimer's disease because these treatments for Alzheimer's disease, but that's only the cause of 60% of all dementia. So you've got another 40% have different symptoms. I mean, obviously, Bruce Willis recently got diagnosed with FTD, frontal temporal dementia, that has very different symptoms. Speech, obviously, was something he lost. Some focus more on coordination, some's memory loss and confusion. Others can be loss of inhibitions. Like there's a whole range. It's depending on, and you don't have to get all of them just because you have one of those subtypes of dementia. So I think it really depends, but it's all about that person's quality of life, how they're responding, how you help them have the best quality of life and their family around them. Because obviously with dementia, you do often have a carer. I mean, the number of people with dementia is about 900,000. It's about to go to 1.6 million by 2040. And the cost to the economy is almost going to hit $100 billion by that point. And that's due to the carer and the fact that carers also have to give up work to look after people and things like that. So there's a huge amount going on. And it's all about how do you and your family dynamic cope and give the best quality of life to the individual with dementia and everyone else. There is no right and wrong answer. And actually, you mentioned too, I have 4, 6, and an 8-year-old. It's the same thing. I read every book around how to be a parent. And when I found out on like day 3 is I have no idea. And I'll do whatever it takes to get through having a 4, 6, and 8-year-old. They're the boss. I know that. But as soon as you think you've got it sus, that's when you know it's all gone. So it's you do whatever you need to do. If they say don't co-sleep and you co-sleep and everyone gets sleep, you co-sleep, in my opinion. So I think it's you have to manage it, and you can ask advice, you can check in with people. Alzheimer's Society has lots of good resources online. We have a helpline you can call up. We've got dementia advisors in certain locations that can come and speak to you about it. So reach out, ask, but you know what's best for your family, and I'd encourage you to do whatever that is to be able to do that. And just to say, I mean, we talked about Alzheimer's Society and people doing a bit of fundraising, and just a plug, if that's like, I mean, Alzheimer's Society, our resources, our research, we've been funding research for 30 years. Like I say, the current drugs and breakthroughs are based on our research. Mm-hmm. We can only do that because people sign up for things like memory walks, which are all around the UK. They attend those, they remember loved ones and friends and family, and they donate a bit of money. And that money goes to funding our research, funding things like our website and health and the information on that. And it's so, and so important. We're a charity and we're massively dependent on that. So thank you to anyone who has done that. And if you would like to, please look at the Alzheimer's Society website and find all the details.
Yeah, absolutely. That will be linked below.
I did the Great North Run, which was like a half marathon, can't remember. I did that.
Look at me as though I would know.
Yeah. I did a run. I ran far, raised some money. Good times.
Well, it all adds up. It doesn't matter how big or how little. It's really a question. And this is like part of, we talked about at the very beginning, kind of debunking dementia and tackling the stigma and everyone talking about it and everyone doing a little bit. I think one of the things when I work in academia, I talk to people in the US and some of the researchers there and the charities there, and they're kind of set up very differently. You have one person giving a lot of money in a trust fund that kind of funds their charities. Here it's really different. It's lots of people giving really little. Like your £2, your £3, but lots of people doing it makes a massive difference. And we have some really big charities that are funded off those little donations that make a massive difference when they all come together. So every little helps. So thank you very much.
Well, yeah, no, I think that's a great place to end this. Thank you so much, Rich. Is there anywhere people could find you?
I'm at Rich James Oakley on Twitter. I have about 12 followers. So if I could get above that, that'd be fantastic. But no, thank you so much. Sorry, I was a little bit late, but it's been a conversation. And we're going to talk for days, I'm sure, about this topic.
Thank you so much. Well, that is all from us. But before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with an extra special thank you to executive producers Donito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday. And why not leave us a nice wee comment? Support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys. Or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com. SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at Luke Cutforth everywhere.
You can follow me at Rich James Oakley on Twitter.
Goodbye.
Goodbye.
See you soon. Bye.